Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's Fourth Branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us today on this Explainer podcast. We're excited to be joined by two cyber and privacy experts. The first, Jennifer Huddleston, who's a research fellow at the Mercatus Center, and Ashley Baker, Director of Public Policy at the Committee for Justice. Ashley, Jennifer, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about Carpenter v. U.S.
Thanks for having us.
Great. Well, before we get into the case that we're here to discuss, I think it takes a little bit of background understanding of what the topic is. Ashley, could you tell us a little bit about what third-party information is and third-party doctrine?
Yeah, sure. So third-party information is any information that you willingly convey, willingly and knowingly, to a third party, such as a bank, such as, you know, a PIN register, dialing a phone number. You know that you're conveying that information to the telephone company, to the bank, or whatever the third party may be. So the third-party doctrine essentially says that you have no right to privacy within that information that's voluntarily conveyed, that the Fourth Amendment does not cover that in the same warrant requirements as it does over versus, you know, a normal, a typical search, because you know that you're giving that data over to a third party. And there are two precedents that kind of establish that, and that was Smith and Miller, both in the 1970s. And what kind of happened with Carpenter is over the years, like Smith and Miller, they initially, the third-party doctrine worked for a while. They were, it was more of an articulation of what the Fourth Amendment did and did not cover. But then it kind of became, over the years, with, you know, the progression of technology, it became kind of more of an exception to the Fourth Amendment itself. And that's kind of how we got here. In Carpenter versus the United States, Timothy Carpenter was convicted of a string of cell phone robberies, a string of robberies of Radio Shack chains. He was actually stealing cell phones, ironically. And his co-conspirator gave his number to the FBI. The FBI was able to track down Carpenter via his cell site location information. Cell site location information, or CSLI data, essentially is data that your phone conveys every time that it connects with a cell phone tower. So it was able to track his movements from day to day. I think it was a period of 7 days that they tracked his movement for. And the Supreme Court decided to overturn the Sixth Circuit decision, 5-4, and determined that the police officers did require a warrant in Carpenter. So it was an interesting decision for a couple of reasons. The basis of their decision was that, you know, by powering on and powering off your cell phone, you don't know that the data is being conveyed. I think the quote was, a cell phone logs a cell site record by dint of its operation without any affirmative acts on the part of the user beyond powering up. So it's interesting. And what another thing that was interesting in the case was that they weren't necessarily talking about the technology use in Carpenter. It was somewhat separated from the facts of the case in Carpenter. I mean, the decision, I think, was correct on the surface. It was superficially correct. You know, they went out of their way to say that this decision was limited, that it was narrow in scope, that it was just meant to apply to CSLI data. And whenever the court goes out of their way to say something is narrow in scope, it usually means that the reasoning of the court is anything but narrow. And that's kind of what happened here. So it might have some interesting implications. The majority talked about, like, seismic shifts in digital technology. They're kind of looking towards the future. So, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I want to stop just for a moment there, because I want to really nail down this idea of third-party information. So if what I'm hearing you say is correct, give us an example of, like, from a layman's perspective, when somebody's creating third-party data. So you mentioned, like, bank PIN numbers, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. So in other words, does the information, the basically any information that you give during course of business to, mm-hmm. You know, any kind of the companies or people that you work with, that can tell us a little bit about what the third-party doctrine says about what the government can and cannot do with that, getting that data.
So originally, this was designed in a more analog era, a type of era where when you call the phone number, you might be interacting with an operator, or there would be a register of some kind of those numbers that were being dialed. And what happened was the idea was you knew you were sharing this information with someone else, and therefore a warrant level protection wasn't necessary. This could be done via a simple request from law enforcement. So it wasn't that this information was just generally broadcast to the public necessarily, but that if there was an investigation involved, that those kind of heightened warrant restrictions that we see for other information weren't required. Now, what's happened is gradually times have changed and new technology has come along where one doesn't necessarily think about the way that information is shared with that external party the same way you did back in the day when there was a telephone operator. So what Carpenter really raised the question of and kind of challenged and asked was, is this doctrine, is this idea that you've waived privacy by the mere nature that there's another party involved in the interaction, actually still work in our modern era where we're constantly interacting with third parties just by the nature of our kind of existence in society? As the case mentioned and as Ashley mentioned earlier, by powering up your phone, you're naturally sharing location information, for example. Carpenter attempted to narrowly tailor that just to those specific cases where there was a kind of incidental use of this information, of, again, going very specifically to cell phone location information. And as Ashley mentioned, the courts really tried to narrowly tailor this, but I think it's also raised a lot of questions given the number of technologies that are out there that are using information in some ways, that there's now this kind of gray area of what protection and coverage does that information have, and what, if any, technologies does the third-party doctrine still apply to?
Yeah, and to kind of go off of that, so the real conclusion in Carpenter, since they did try to narrowly tailor it, but the reasoning was so broad, was really just that the third-party doctrine is no longer the bright-line rule that it used to be, which means that law enforcement's going to think more about getting a warrant. They might be encouraged to do so, and they're going to be thinking about metadata, too, in a way that they didn't have to do so before.
And say, I think another real takeaway from the conclusion of Carpenter is how the court is able to adapt with technology. It might not necessarily be as quickly as we wish it would be sometimes, but that the court is taking into account these changes we've seen, particularly by emerging technologies.
Well, there's another aspect of that, too. One of the most interesting things, if not the most interesting thing, about the decision in Carpenter was Gorsuch's dissent, which really read more like a concurrence, but he was clearly setting the groundwork for the future of Fourth Amendment law, I think, and for him to kind of lay that groundwork in the future. And essentially what he would like to do is to discard eventually of the third-party doctrine and go back to a positive law approach, to a property rights approach. Essentially, you have a property interest in your data. So Jennifer was saying that the courts have been adapting to technology. If you take into account like Gorsuch's reasoning and take that approach, they don't necessarily have to the same extent. I think there's
So real quick, let me ask. Walk me through, you mentioned the ruling in Carpenter, but walk me through a little bit of like what did they rule on whether it was location information was the key to Carpenter, or was the key evidentiary question, and how did they rule whether that the data of the cell phone pinging that tower could be procured? Did the police need a warrant or not?
Well, as every good defense attorney likes to say, come back with a warrant. What they ruled was not that law enforcement couldn't ever have access to this information, but that given the nature of this information, the third-party doctrine exception did not apply to allow them to more easily obtain it with a mere request, but rather that they would need to go through additional steps to actually formally request this, either with a warrant, I believe it was.
Yes,
a warrant
without the – before Carpenter, police officers were able to use the lower standards under the Stored Communications Act, which is – essentially a subpoena. It's kind of this weird hybrid, I would say, between a warrant and a subpoena. What kind of the basis, though, of their reasoning was that cell phone location information is conveyed unwittingly. Just like they said, by powering on, powering off, that's how it's conveyed. You don't know necessarily when your phone is connecting to a tower, and in order to, for, you know, that not to happen, you would just need to opt out of modern society.
Got it. So they basically argued that the, or they ruled, excuse me, that that the third party doctrine that was established in the prior cases of Miller and
Smith
didn't apply because there was a lack of consent. In other words, because there were, the average person doesn't have any idea that they're transferring information when they turn their phone on. You can't then say that they've given up a privacy right in that information. Do I have that generally correct? Or
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you mentioned Gorsuch's dissent, which is a very interesting note. I think and that seems to be signaling a direction that he would like the court to go, that maybe even sounds like more restrictive for the ability of law enforcement to get information without warrants. Am I reading that right? Or?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And actually, that's you can trace his views on that back to his lower court decisions too in the Tenth Circuit, particularly one United States versus Ackerman, in which he applies the test, but also he kind of gets at the trespass theory and the property argument as well.
Interesting.
So it
sounds like the majority of the court wanted to restrict the ability of law enforcement to get this information without a warrant. But then in addition, there was at least one additional justice who would like to have even gone further.
Right.
And
but he was also, one important thing to remember is he was also sending a message to future litigants that he would not, you know, you wouldn't have his vote if you would not incorporate the property-based argument.
I see. Yeah. I see. Very interesting. Very interesting. Well, what does this mean for law enforcement going forward? How is this going to change their ability to do their work?
It heightens the bar a little bit. To be clear, it doesn't prevent them from getting this information, but it provides a kind of additional civil liberties check on this particular type of cell phone location information by now requiring a warrant. There are some questions of exactly how narrowly tailored this is and could it apply to other forms of data as well. But in general, it seems that the courts have so far taken a very narrow approach. Now, there are some other interesting cases along the way, and some states are asking some interesting questions about other data, about, you know, whether or not this is kind of a first signal that we need to have more formalized warrant protections when it comes to law enforcement use of all the different kinds of data, whether it's your Fitbit, whether it's an IoT device like an Alexa, whether it's, you know, Facebook data. Is this kind of a, we need to adapt the Fourth Amendment to our modern digital age? And what we've seen is these questions are going to increasingly come up in our legal system as we have more and more different devices that we're using. Some states have started to consider this issue. Utah passed a law this last term providing additional warrant requirements for electronic information that an individual may have. So kind of taking Carpenter and extending it more fully to an individual's data on a state level, because they considered that that's the way that this jurisprudence was eventually going to end up.
Right. And to add to that, law enforcement, so the court's reasoning in Carpenter, though, logically applies to other types of data. It can apply to the Internet of Things, artificial intelligence, facial recognition. So law enforcement might be more willing to, you know, go get a warrant in those cases because, you know, they'd rather be safe than sorry. They don't want, you know, evidence to be inadmissible in court because they needed to go get a warrant. While the state legislation's a good start, I mean, ideally, Congress could, you know, strengthen statutory requirements under the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, or ECPA. They've tried to reform that for years since 1986, but have been unsuccessful at really doing that.
Excellent. So what do you guys think happened? What do you guys think happens next? Is there going to be, you mentioned there's legislation in Utah and some of the states are trying to deal with this. Do you think it's likely that there's a case before the Supreme Court on this or a related matter in the near term?
No, probably not anytime in the future. I mean, the robberies in Carpenter happened in 2011. They were robbing Radio Shacks. So that tells you how out of date the actual case was. And it does take things a long time to make it up to the court. I mean, there are a few other Fourth Amendment issues where there could be a circuit split, such as the border exception requirement or compelled encryption, which is really a Fifth Amendment issue, if you cut that part out. In terms of the third-party doctrine, I think it might be a while, but that's why Gorsuch being in the court is particularly promising, too, is because he is the court's youngest justice as of now, and he is clearly laying the groundwork for, you know, the future of the Fourth Amendment.
Very interesting.
In some ways, the courts, like all other forms of public policy-related bodies, face a pacing problem when it comes to technology. Technology moves faster than traditional modes of policymaking, whether it's legislation or, you know, litigation that ultimately rises to the Supreme Court and tries to answer some of these difficult questions in the gray area. I think it'll be interesting to see. I think there are plenty of questions left unanswered by Carpenter as we see more and more technologies come on board. I think you will see questions in lower courts, and it's just, it's a matter of time before the Supreme Court has to re-examine whether or not Carpenter is more expansive than just cell phone location information, what role the third-party doctrine has, or if you see some sort of congressional legislation in the meantime. I think, it as Ashley pointed out, it does take a long time for a case to make it to the Supreme Court, and my guess is that you would see several lower cases before you saw that kind of next challenge.
Yeah, I mean, I disagree with you a little bit. I would not call it a pacing problem necessarily, because I don't think the courts should have a pacing problem. It takes a long time for it to get to the Supreme Court, not because of a pacing problem, just because of process-related concerns. But generally, I have a bit of a problem with the premise of, like, new technology, new law every single time. And kind of to go back to Justice Gorsuch, actually, there was a moment during his confirmation hearing when Senator Hatch asked him about, you know, cases involving technology and how are we supposed to apply something that's 200 years old to new forms of technology. And his reply was essentially new technology, same principles. So with his approach, we can go back to the Constitution. Therefore, you don't really have a pacing problem. So I would say that doesn't apply to the courts.
Oh, I would agree with that. I would say that one of the advantages of common law is its ability to adapt mm-hmm. to new technology. I merely was pointing out when there are these gray areas and concerns and you may have these splits that it can take a long time to get a resolution. And so there's always that question of what happens, and particularly on an individual basis or for individual attorneys that may be grappling with these issues, until you have that certainty of either Supreme Court precedent or federal legislation, there can be some confusion as the common law tries to adapt.
Yeah, I mean, we managed to poke a hole in the third-party doctrine, at least, and no longer kind of asking the question of what's left of the Fourth Amendment. For a while, it was very much a large hole, it was very much an exception. So, like Jennifer said, getting back to the text of the Constitution, a positive law approach does that.
Makes sense. Well, let me ask perhaps the most important question for all of this. What does it mean to the average person? Has this affect their lives, or what? What changes from Carpenter v. U.S. do you think they would see?
Don't steal cell phones.
I think it does signal that there is an increasing awareness of data as it relates to the Fourth Amendment, and that we are going to see that play out both in terms of law enforcement, maybe, as Ashley pointed out, seeking warrants more often, but also in terms of kind of a general asking of questions in these cases of where that line is and what is the appropriate standard for law enforcement being able to access that information.
It also changes their perception of the court. A lot of the public just views the court as, you know, technologically incompetent. They are definitely the branch of government that is the least technologically advanced. I would argue that that doesn't necessarily matter, but I think this does go a little ways to reassure them.
Great. Well, actually, let me ask a follow-up question on this, because it just kind of hit me that there might be an interesting legal wrinkle to this. It sounds like what was a core part of the case in Carpenter was that he had no knowledge and no reason to have knowledge that his phone was giving away his location when he turned it on. Now, a lot of tech companies these days have rather expansive terms of service because they want to basically be able to do whatever they want with your data for purely business reasons. Would this affect a potential future case? So in sounds like in Carpenter, he had never signed a document that said that the cell phone company would track him or that kind of thing. But with a lot of terms of service for different websites and different services, you mentioned Fitbit, Jennifer, you do often sign, or at least, you know, click agree to something that, that ostensibly, you know, notifies you that, that your information is going to be tracked. Could that have an effect in future cases? If, in other words, could it come down to whether you agreed to the terms of service?
I mean, I think in with cell phone data, I'm not sure exactly what his terms of service are, but they are relying, well, the some of the dissents, I think it was Justice Alito's dissent, relied on the fact that it's apparent that your phone is connecting to something. That's why, you know, when you get into an elevator, you don't have reception, for example. So I don't know. One issue that kind of brushes on, though, that I think was interesting is the cell phone location data at the time wasn't nearly as precise as it is now, and the court was ruling as if it were. So they were kind of looking forward instead of looking at what was happening in the case. That's actually kind of one of my problems with the reasoning. And the, like I said, I think they got it right overall. But with the court's reasoning is that they were looking towards future technology. And, you know, what if in, let's see, 7 years from them? What if from 7 years from, you know, the next case, that's not how the technology evolves? And a lot of the amicus briefs, too, kind of portrayed the technology as it is today and not as it was then. So the court, you know, they were writing for, you know, their future audience and kind of writing for, I guess, like, yeah, their, I don't want to say their legacy, but they're writing for, you know, future readers, and to kind of show that they, you know, cared about these issues, and they're using language to seismic shifts in technology, and what's the other one? And that they're going to be careful not to embarrass the future, but that's kind of not the purpose of the law, to consider what the future may hold.
On the other hand, you don't want to have a ruling about this third-party doctrine issue that's so narrowly tailored that it's out of date as soon as it comes down. So I think they were trying to make sure that it was still a ruling that held given today's technology and given where technology is heading. But back to the original question, I think that is one of the questions that we're going to see pop up in courts in the coming years. I think of at what point was it you knew that you were giving this information to a third party doctor, to a third party? What at what point is it the same as interacting with that bank teller? Is going to be kind of that question that I think if we see another challenge will be one of the things that has to be grappled with.
And I think it's evident they thought it would be an important case in the future just because they granted the case. There was no circuit split in this case. And usually if there's no circuit split, that means it's an issue of particular importance. So that in and of itself indicates that they thought it would be of some importance in the future.
Jennifer, Ashley, thank you so much for joining us today. This is very interesting and deals areas obviously that affect the average person day to day as they generate lots and lots of data. So thank you for this conversation.
Thank you for having us.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.